is to go over a bunch of handouts. So you want to be sure you have them and you scribble all over them, because that's what you're going to need to do today. Now I want to start by referring to the question we brought up last time, which is that we know that the same neurotransmitter, or for that matter, the same hormone, so maybe I should say the same signaling molecule, can produce different results in different cells. And we wanted to consider how that is true. And in the top of 19B, if you have it, but if you don't, it probably isn't necessary, we said that epinephrine, also known as adrenaline, this is the meeting a crisis hormone, that it has different effects on skeletal muscle, on the smooth muscle, in the lungs, and on smooth muscle in the peripheral circulation. We said that in response to the proverbial pop quiz, or the sudden reminder that the exam is tomorrow and you forgot about it, in your skeletal, you release epinephrine, and in your skeletal muscle, you break down glycogen. In the smooth muscle surrounding the bronchioles, the tubes of your lungs, those muscles, in fact, can relax. So here you have glycogen breakdown. That makes sense. That generates glucose for energy metabolism. The smooth muscle around your bronchioles relaxes, so you can breathe deeper, you can get more oxygen, and you can have better energy metabolism. And the smooth muscles around the arterioles, the small vessels in your peripheral circulation, in fact, contract, thereby diverting the blood supply from your extremities to the main parts of your body and the brain. Now, I just want to say that there is smooth muscle around the arterioles, but not around the very small branches, the capillaries. The very finest blood vessels do not have smooth muscle. And similarly, the part of your lungs in which there is gas exchange doesn't have smooth muscle around it either, but the tubes leading up to them does. So you can see why all this makes sense, but the question is, how does one signal molecule, can you get three different responses? Now, we mentioned last time, and it's diagrammed in detail on your handout, that these two kinds of cells actually get the response using the same signaling pathway. They have the same receptor. The receptor triggers the same G protein. The G protein triggers the cyclic AMP pathway. The details are written on your handout, but the net result is that you activate protein kinase A. Now, we've explained before that this phosphorylates different target enzymes. Which enzymes it will phosphorylate will depend on what enzymes are present in the cell. Now, in your skeletal muscle, this enzyme phosphorylates proteins that are involved in glycogen metabolism. Phosphorylation activates the ones for breakdown and inhibits the ones for synthesis. So the net effect is to activate the enzymes needed to break down glycogen, get glucose, and operate. But in the smooth muscle of the lungs, you don't have glycogen. You don't have the enzymes to make glycogen, but you do have actin and myosin for contraction, as all muscles do. And what this does, PKA phosphorylates one of the enzymes you need for contraction. Now, without going into all of it, it's the only thing that it says on your handout is that the enzyme, which is known as MLCK, which is in fact a kinase itself, and whose target is myosin. Remember, myosin is the motor molecule of actin. It is responsible for splitting ATP and making muscles move, as we will explain in greater detail probably next time. But this enzyme has to work in order for smooth muscle to contract. And PKA phosphorylates it, and it in fact doesn't work. So phosphorylation can activate an enzyme, it can inactivate it. And in this case, you're inactivating the enzyme needed for contraction, so you are blocking contraction. Now that means if the muscle doesn't contract, it relaxes. So if it relaxes, that enlarges the size of your bronchioles, that allows you to breathe deeply, etc. Now, this actually is not a new idea. We earlier discussed a case where the same compound, the same signal molecule, in fact it was epinephrine, had different effects on two tissues because they had different target proteins. For example, we said what happens in the liver in response to epinephrine is different than what happens in your skeletal muscle. In the liver, you do the same thing, that is, you break down glycogen. But you do additional things as well. You do gluconeogenesis and you release glucose. So you do more things in the liver because there are more targets of PKA to be activated. So this is not really a new idea, it's just a new example. But it turns out that the difference between what happens in the smooth muscle of the lungs and what happens in the smooth muscles surrounding your arterioles is not due to different target proteins. After all, these are both smooth muscle cells. They have very similar proteins inside. And yet one contracts and the other relaxes. And the difference here turns out to be in the receptors. They have different receptors that trigger different signal transduction pathways. That the receptor here is different. It's what is called a beta adrenergic receptor. And the receptor here is what's called an alpha adrenergic receptor. You may remember last time, we said there are two major neurotransmitters in the peripheral nervous system. And we said that one of them, which was acetylcholine, has two different receptors. So we said that acetylcholine receptors come in two flavors, two different kinds. They're called nicotinic and muscarinic. One is direct and one is indirect. The critical point is same neurotransmitter, two different receptors. Well, the other major neurotransmitter in the peripheral nervous system is norepinephrine. Norepinephrine and epinephrine are very similar, and they use the same receptors. And they, too, come in two basic flavors, alpha and beta. Now, you don't need to do it now, but there is a table in your notes from last time that summarizes the properties of these four because it keeps coming up over and over again, and it's there for reference. But what we have to remember is that each of these neurotransmitters has two classes of receptor, and for better or worse, each class of receptor is usually split into several different kinds as well. So there's more than two receptors, but there's two basic types. Now, turns out that each of these then uses one of the different receptors. Now, these receptors are known as cholinergic receptors because they work on acetylcholine, or adrenergic receptors because they work on epinephrine, norepinephrine, also known as adrenaline, noradrenaline. Now, I apologize for the terminology, but I didn't invent it. And that's what people do. So what we want to see is, we know how a receptor can trigger the cyclic AMP pathway. We've discussed that before. But how can a receptor trigger a different pathway? In fact, the IP3 pathway. And the time has come to look more carefully at how signaling with IP3 works. This is an excuse to go over it, and it's on handout 20A. Now, what we've drawn here on the top for comparison is the standard pathway we already talked about for how you can trigger the cyclic AMP pathway. We said you have a receptor, and this picture is very similar to the one on your previous handout, except for this little part here. You have a receptor and a ligand. They get it together. That activates the receptor. That activates a G protein. The G protein activates adenyl cyclase, which is an enzyme which converts ATP to cyclic AMP. The ligand, say epinephrine, whatever, is our first messenger. Cyclic AMP is our second or internal messenger, intracellular. And now it will bind to and activate protein kinase A. And we know now that that will phosphorylate target proteins and make them work better or worse. And we discussed some of the details of this last time. Now, what's the situation with the IP3 pathway? It is in some ways very similar. I think I better draw it this way, or the pictures will not fit. Now, the same idea that you have a receptor. Now, in this particular case, to keep it simple, I've not only drawn the two receptors as looking different, but I've actually drawn them so that they bind different ligands. And we'll come back to this case over here of how can the same ligand trigger both of these pathways. But to keep it simple right now, we're assuming two different receptors, two different ligands. So the ligand here looks like this. Here's the receptor. Again, the receptor activates a G protein. But you see here that the G protein is a little bit different. There's actually more than one G protein. And this G protein, the first one, binds to and activates adenyl cyclase, while this G protein binds to and activates a different enzyme, phospholipase C, abbreviated PLC. Somebody asked last time about the G protein. When you activate it, does it go into the cytoplasm? The G protein is anchored to the membrane by a lipid anchor, and so are both halves of it. So when it is split and activated, both halves are still attached to the membrane. However, cyclic AMP is free in the cytoplasm, and the second messenger in this system, IP3, or one of them, is free in the cytoplasm. Now, phospholipase C, as its name implies, splits a phospholipid. And that phospholipid is actually in the membrane. So if you look at the bottom of your handout, we've actually drawn what that phospholipid is. The phospholipid is something like this. Now, what does this represent? If you look at the last picture on your left, you see it's labeled. This is a standard phospholipid would end here. You have two fatty acids linked to glycerol. And then this is a phospholipid, so there's a phosphate, and then there's some sort of alcohol and maybe some other modifications. And the alcohol in this case is inositol. Now, it turns out that variants of this molecule are highly involved in signaling. The part up to the dotted line is the part drawn in your left picture and is simply called PI, or phosphatidyl inositol. But what a picture that I drew here is phosphatidyl inositol plus two more phosphates. So it's known as PIP2, among other things. It has other names. Now, why should this molecule be used in signaling? Well, of course, the answer is it is. But one rationale is inositol is an alcohol. It's circular, and it has six carbons. And all of them have hydroxyls. One of them is linked up here to connect to the rest of the phospholipid. So when you make phosphatidyl inositol, the inositol hanging off the end has five hydroxyls on it. And therefore, you can make, by phosphorylation, umpteen variations. No phosphates, one phosphate, two phosphates, all the way up to five. Now, this is the most common variant, which has phosphates in the 4 and 5 position. And that's PIP2, but PIP3 is also used in signaling. It has an additional phosphate on, I think, position 3. But you can see that you can make many variants of this in terms of adding, losing phosphates, and they're thought to be, therefore, many of these variants are involved in signaling and in different purposes. We're going to stick to PIP2, which is the best known. So how is this related to a membrane? If we had a membrane here, a bilayer, with its phospholipids the way we usually draw them, what would this be? Well, these are the fatty acid parts, and this is the head group. So it would look like something like this. Here would be the glycerol. Here would be the phosphate. Something like this. So the fatty acid glycerol part would be in the membrane, but the inositol with the phosphates would be sticking out either at the edge or into the cytoplasm. Now, what does PLC do? PLC actually splits it, not where I drew that dotted line, but on the other side, so maybe I'll get some colored chalk for that. Phospholipase C splits it here. So if I split it there, what am I going to release? I'm going to release inositol with three phosphates on it. And so that's called IP3. It has other names as well, inositol, P3, etc. But so the beginning part is phosphatidyl inositol. We add two phosphates to it, and then we cleave off as a second messenger the inositol with all three phosphates. And so phospholipase C actually works on a lipid in the membrane. So that's why I wrote it on your handout like this. PIP2 is actually on your membrane. And by the action of phospholipase C, you free the IP3, which can now move through the cytoplasm and act as a second messenger. IP3 and cyclic AMP are two of the most famous second messengers. The only other one with equivalent standing is calcium. And let me just remind you that biologists tend to write calcium plus plus, but chemists tend to write calcium 2 plus. But it's the same thing. It's the bivalent ion. Now, it's worth mentioning that when we split off the IP3, what happens? What do we leave in the membrane? Notice that the part to the left here is in the membrane. And that is actually glycerol with two fatty acids, or diacylglycerol. So the action of phospholipase C actually generates two small molecules, both of which can act as messengers. One of them is DAG, diacylglycerol, and the other is IP3. Now we're going to focus on IP3 because IP3 is actually in the cytosol and can move around and trigger things. DAG also can act as a messenger, but only in the membrane. It's lipid-soluble and remains in the membrane. IP3 is water-soluble and goes in the cytoplasm. Okay, so what does it do? We know what pKa does. The target of cyclic AMP is pKa. pKa phosphorylates proteins. What do IP3 and DAG do? DAG actually usually activates a series of proteins or kinases which are known as protein kinase C. This is really not one protein, but a family of proteins which have many different functions. But we're going to focus on what IP3 does. The primary thing that IP3 does is to bind to receptors on the surface of the endoplasmic reticulum. And to open channels in the endoplasmic reticulum. In many cells, the endoplasmic reticulum stores calcium. Calcium in the cytosol is very low, but calcium inside the ER and outside the cell are relatively high. So in response to IP3, these channels open, and calcium flows down its gradient into the ER, into the cytoplasm from the ER. How are we going to restore the normal low calcium state? What does this cell have to have? Well, where is that calcium going to go? It ought to go back where it came from. Is that up its gradient or down its gradient? This is going to be, it came out down its gradient. To go back, it has to go up. So it's going to actually have to be pushed by energy, by ATP. So there's actually a pump here driven by ATP, which is going to put the calcium back. But for the moment, we have a pulse of calcium, and that acts as a second or third messenger to get something done. We already know that calcium promotes exocytosis. It also promotes muscle contraction and a bunch of other interesting things. Now, how does calcium trigger anything? Sometimes, as shown in your handout, calcium simply binds to a protein directly and alters activity. So just like cyclic AMP can bind to a protein and alter its activity, so can calcium, and for that matter, many other ions. But another way that calcium acts, which is very common, is that calcium binds to a famous calcium binding protein, and then that binds to the target and changes the target's effectiveness. And the famous calcium binding protein is called calmodulin. So sometimes you form a calcium calmodulin complex, and that then binds to some protein and activates or inhibits it. So you'd say you can have the direct effect of calcium or indirect. In both cases, you alter protein activity. And as indicated here, the usual things that you change are either a phosphatase, taking phosphates off of proteins, or a kinase, which puts phosphates onto proteins. Now, in our picture here, we have two different signal transduction pathways, two different ways of generating a second messenger, but they're different second messengers. In one case, it's IP3, which leads to calcium. In one place, it's cyclic AMP, which activates PKA. Now, we know that some hormones can trigger this one, like epinephrine, for example. And some hormones trigger this one. I didn't have time to look up a good example. I think that vasopressin, also known as antidiuretic hormone, uses IP3, I think. But we now want to go back to the situation we were thinking about. How does one hormone trigger this in one cell and that in another? There are actually two interesting cases to think about. We said that you can have two hormones that trigger the same pathway. We said that much earlier. When we talked about epinephrine and glucagon, we said that in skeletal muscle, they produce the same result. They trigger cyclic AMP production, glycogen breakdown, but for different reasons. One is to maintain homeostasis. One is to give you the energy to run away from the lion. But we just talked about a case where the same hormone gives you different pathways in different cells. We said that epinephrine in one kind of smooth muscle triggers the IP3 pathway and one the cyclic AMP pathway. So I want to consider, how can we change our picture to fit either of these cases? Now, this is meant to be epinephrine. This is what epinephrine does, binds to a receptor, affects the G protein that binds to adenyl cyclase, you get cyclic AMP, etc. How could glucagon have the same effect? Could it use the same receptor? Well, glucagon chemically is very different from epinephrine. Glucagon is actually a peptide. We could say if that's epinephrine, glucagon looks like this. Well, probably it's a lot bigger, but it looks completely different. Can I use the same receptor? No way. But the receptor has to do the same thing. It has to activate the same G protein and kick in the same series of events. So what would its receptor look like? Well, let's see. It would have to bind to the same G protein, but it would have a binding site that binds glucagon instead of epinephrine. So a cell that responds to both is going to have both kinds of receptors. A cell that responds only to glucagon will have this kind, only epinephrine, this kind. All right. But now, how do I change my picture so that epinephrine can trigger either of these responses? First of all, which cell type is which? And how do I fix the picture? So, you think about that for a minute. Which cell type is which, and how do I fix the picture? Is this the alpha adrenergic, the alpha 1, or the beta adrenergic? How many people think it's beta? Alpha. Too early in the morning. Okay. So it's either alpha or too early in the morning. Well, the answer is it's alpha. Here we're generating IP3, so we must be talking about this pathway here. We're talking about the smooth muscle of the peripheral circulation. It must have, this would be epinephrine, must bind to the receptor and trigger this pathway. So what's this one? This must be a beta adrenergic receptor, and epinephrine binds, etc. Well, if epinephrine is binding here, what's wrong with this picture? This receptor doesn't bind epinephrine. This could be, so I have to change, what part do I have to change? I have to change this part. So I have to say that what we have here is a receptor that looks like this. So its ligand binding site is the same. When it's binding epinephrine, it has the same approximate ligand binding site. But, and this is an epinephrine receptor. This is an epinephrine receptor. So these are both adrenergic receptors. They both bind epinephrine, but they stick to different and activate different G proteins. So they have to be different in other respects. The part that sticks to the G protein has to be different. And these G proteins, in fact, are different. So what we're saying is that in the smooth vessel, the smooth muscle of your lung, what you have is something like this one. You have that kind of receptor. And in the smooth muscle of your peripheral circulation, you have receptors that look like this. Some smooth muscle has one kind of receptor, some has the other, some even have a combination. Now, I think for now that's enough about signaling per se, but let me ask what questions there are before we move on. Yeah?
What's that second receptor that you had
registered
before?
What's this?
Under alpha, yeah.
Well, this would have to be an alpha receptor. This would have to be a receptor that activates this G protein but responds to a different ligand. We know that the same cell can have receptors that bind different ligands and activate the same G protein. Well, in a smooth muscle cells respond to a large number of different hormones and neurotransmitters. As we will see, skeletal muscle responds only to acetylcholine, and all it does is contract. Either it does nothing or it contracts. But there's only one thing that can tell it what to do in the contraction department. Smooth muscle, on the other hand, contracts in response to a whole bunch of contracts or relaxes in response to a whole bunch of different things. Now, it does have receptors for most smooth muscle has receptors both for acetylcholine and for epinephrine, and usually they are both indirect. Because remember, of these three well-known and famous receptors, this one, the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, is itself a channel, an ionotropic direct receptor. But the other three are indirect metabotropic receptors that use second messengers. So these can produce many different and varied effects. The direct one has only one effect. It can open its channels, and that's it. Any other questions about the signaling business? Yeah?
The calcium channel in the ER, is it just IP3 binds to it and it opens?
I don't remember off the top of my head whether this channel and in the receptor are one thing or two separate things. I think the receptor is itself a channel. Yes?
How does the beta blocker drugs work?
Beta blockers are generally antagonists of the beta of epinephrine, norepinephrine. They block the beta receptor. Now remember, there's more than one kind of beta receptor, really. And one of the tricks with beta blockers is to get one that will block the part you're interested in and not something else. Yeah?
Is what goes on between the receptor and the AC or the TLC the same? Like the workings of it in terms of the units?
Okay, the question is, do both of these G proteins operate sort of the same way, that they're trimeric, that the alpha disassociates from the beta gamma, that it requires GTP, all that's the same. Now, the part of which part of the G protein is then the activator of the next step may be different. Okay. So we've talked a lot now about various kinds of signals and signaling, and now we want to consider how does the signal trigger an action in the effector? Because after all, using one of these neurotransmitters in the peripheral nervous system, you're going to get a gland or a muscle to do something, to contract, to secrete, etc. And how does that work? So we want to look at a case involving skeletal muscle, the simplest possible circuit. And for this, you need your handout 20B. The bottom of this handout shows a simple circuit. Now, what do I mean by a circuit? You have incoming information from your sensory neurons, from your sensory system. You detect stretch or light or heat or sound. And in response to that, some muscle or gland does something. That's the effector. So here is the simplest possible sort of in information, out information. This is meant to be a muscle. Actually, a skeletal muscle. And this is a neuron that detects stretch. This is a receptor or sensory neuron. And remember, the kind that detects stretch, the same cell has receptor proteins on one end to detect stretch, and it has voltage-gated channels to generate an action potential on the other end. And usually these cells have their cell body off to one side, which is why they're written this way. So this is a sensory neuron. It's also a receptor cell. Now, this issue came up last time. How does this cell detect stretch? It has receptor proteins, and when they are mechanically deformed, you open channels. So these receptor proteins trigger the opening of channels. But what is it that triggers the opening of those channels? It's not binding chemicals, it's not voltage, it's mechanical processes. And this happens to be a direct system, as you may remember from last time, meaning that the proteins that detect stretch are themselves channels. So it's one of those situations where the protein looks like this, and if you bend the protein, it opens. So stretch mechanically deforms the channel and allows a few ions to go through. And then we have the famous Big Bang. If enough ions go through, that changes the voltage. You generate voltage-gated, you open voltage-gated channels. You generate an action potential. Now, this is information coming into the central nervous system, so it's called afferent. And it actually comes in not to your brain, but to your spinal cord, to a neuron whose body is in your spinal cord. That's the neuron right here. And it has a long axon, which goes back to the muscle. So we have one neuron feeding information into the spinal cord, or the central nervous system. And we have one neuron with an axon going back out of the central nervous system. So this is called efferent. Things have to go in, and then the result comes out. Trying to remember which is afferent and which is efferent, one of my TAs came up with A before E. So you have to come in, you have to get information in before you can decide to send any out. Now, how does this work? How many synapses do we have in this system? Two? Well, this is a synapse right here. Okay? So we have a little cleft right here. This is the presynaptic cell. The postsynaptic cell, you're going to release neurotransmitter. This is a synapse. Where's the other one? This is not a synapse. This is a sensory nerve ending. This is a receptor. Okay. This is a synapse also, but this is a synapse between nerve and muscle. So we have only one nerve-nerve signal synapse here. That's what we mean by the simplest possible, but you're quite right. This is a synapse too, but this is a nerve muscle. Nerve muscle signals are always positive, and they always use acetylcholine, and they use this nicotinic direct receptor. So what happens here, we know. How's this going to work? You're going to have stretch, You're going to try and pick something up, and that's going to stretch, pull the stretch receptors in your muscle. That's going to generate an action potential. That's going to then cause neurotransmission across to here. Now, are we going to excite this neuron, or are we going to inhibit this neuron? If this neuron has an action potential, what will happen? If there's an action potential, it will secrete neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, and that will cause the muscle to contract. That's what we want to have happen. So the stretch coming in is going to trigger an action potential in this cell, which will, in fact, cause the muscle to contract. Another way of, but remember, what would make the muscle relax? Nothing. No signal. There's no such thing as a, hey, relax. There's only a, hey, contract. No signal means relax. So, what kind of, is this an excitatory or an inhibitory synapse? It has to be excitatory. So this is, you're going to generate an excitatory postsynaptic potential here. Meaning, what kind of channels are you going to open? Who's going to move? Well, primarily sodium. But remember, both sodium and potassium usually move. To get an excitatory postsynaptic potential, you usually open cation channels, which allow both sodium and potassium to move, but the amount of sodium that moves washes out the effects of the potassium. So that's what's going to happen here. Now, this is very simple, but as you all know, muscles come in pairs. In order to bend over, I have to contract stuff in the middle, but I've got to relax the other stuff or it won't work. I'll get stuck. The famous example of this is your hand, your arm. Then in order to do this, you have to stretch this out and you have to contract this. So this is contracted and this is relaxed. Now to do this, I have to do the reverse. I have to contract this one and relax that one. Now you don't want to contract them both at the same time. If you do, you'll have paralysis. That's what lockjaw tetanus does. You don't want to relax them both at the same time either. I don't know what would happen. You'd be in the middle somewhere. So you want always, when one, to give a signal to one to contract, you don't want a signal to the other, and vice versa. So how that is set up is shown in the second picture. So what we have added here is the contrasting muscle, the antagonistic muscle. Anytime one of them contracts, we want the other to relax, and vice versa. And of course, we're going to have a neuron, which is going to have to be in the spinal cord, which also is going to have an axon to that muscle. Now, this muscle is also going to have sensory receptors in it. There's going to be another sensory neuron here, just like the one on the top. But I have left it off the picture to make your life simple. So I've only drawn one sensory neuron, although there are really two. But I've drawn two so-called motor neurons. Those are the neurons that control the contraction of muscle. So you have to have one to each. But now, how is this going to work? If we have stretch in the top muscle, we're going to tell the top motor neuron to send a signal and tell that muscle to contract. But at the same time, we do not want to send a message to the bottom. We want to block messages to the bottom neuron, the bottom motor neuron. So how are we going to do that? The way you do that is by having an additional branch of the first axon, and you need a third neuron. You need a neuron in between the other two, which is called an interneuron. So it's going to go like this. This one. So now it looks like your picture. Our top sensory neuron contracts both of the two target neurons. One of them goes to the original muscle. One goes to an interneuron, which in turn goes to the antagonistic muscle. Now, if we have a positive here, what do we want here? Do we want to stimulate this neuron? We better not, or you're going to be stuck. So in fact, you're going to have a negative signal here. Now, what about this one? Now, first question. What about the neurotransmitters released by these two at these two synapses? Are they going to be the same?
Yes.
They are, because we learned last time that one neuron generally releases the same neurotransmitter at all of its synapses. So whatever neurotransmitter you have here, you're going to have the same one over here. And in this, but does the receptor have to be the same? It does not. But in this case, the receptor is, these two receptors are the same. So if that's true, what is this? Excitatory or inhibitory?
Excitatory.
This is also excitatory, EPSP. This neuron fires. Well, where are we going to get an action potential now? If this is an excitatory synapse, who's going to fire an action potential? If we get enough input, it's going to be this guy. So it's going to give us an action potential. But what is it going to release? A different neurotransmitter. And it's going to release something that is going, well, either the same neurotransmitter in a different receptor or a different neurotransmitter. In any case, this is an inhibitory synapse. So what's going to happen to this membrane? Is it going to hyperpolarize or depolarize? It's going to hyperpolarize due to the movement of either chloride or potassium, and it's going to inhibit. No, you're going to get no action potential. Now, this is the basic system by which you activate one and inhibit the antagonistic one. And I brought this up because it's an example of how you use all the things we've been talking about, receptors, neurotransmitters, EPSPs, IPSPs, etc. Now, of course, this, the system is more complicated than we let on because, as we said last time, one action potential is not enough to trigger another action potential. You have to have multiple inputs here, either in time or in space, in order to cause this neuron to fire. However, as we will learn, one action potential is sufficient to make the muscle contract one unit. It takes only one action potential to make the muscle respond. Now, the muscle will respond more to more action potentials, but one is enough to get you some action. So when we're talking nerve-nerve, one action potential won't do it. But when we're talking nerve-muscle, one action potential will. Now, there were some questions? Yeah.
What happens to the whole, like, myosin walking along the muscle, or along the...
The myosin business is much smaller than this. Myosin, actin, myosin walking along actin is what shortens this muscle when it contracts. But that's submolecular, and that's inside this.
So is that triggered by this?
Or yes. So all muscles contract... in basically the same way. Haha. We're talking here at the gross level. If you look at the molecular level, all muscles contain both myosin and actin in a setup something like this. The green is myosin and the red is actin. And then there are other connections. When muscles contract, it's not because anything of these gets short. The actin and myosin don't get shorter, but the myosin walks along the actin, or they slide. This is the shortening. This is the lengthening. You have a lot of these in series, and they either all, each unit shortens, because the myosin and the actin slide relative to each other, or when they relax, the actin slides out relative to the myosin. Now, we're going to talk next time about how this is arranged within the cells. Because in skeletal muscle and striated muscle and smooth muscle, it's a little bit different. Yeah?
Is there only one motor neuron going to each muscle cell?
Is there only one motor neuron to each muscle? As far as I know, there is not. There is usually a bundle of neurons. And the more neurons there are, the larger... A nerve is a bundle of neurons, not a single neuron.
But one motor neuron can both stimulate and repress the contraction of the cell, right?
One motor neuron is sufficient to cause contraction, but only a little tiny bit of contraction. But you said one motor neuron is enough to repress. It's not, because there is no such thing as repression here. In the lack of any input, no motor neurons, this muscle will do nothing. If you get one action potential, it will contract a tiny bit. If it gets a bunch in a row or several at once, it will contract a lot. But you look, is that okay?
Well, that was my question, but it's okay.
All right. Yeah, in the back.
If you want the opposite thing to happen, where you contract the top or relax the top, you contract the bottom, would you need a different interneuron?
Yes, you would need an additional interneuron and an additional sensory neuron to make the picture complete. That's correct. Yeah.
Are the two neurons in the bottom circuit both in CNS?
What's in the central nervous system? All of these cell bodies would be in the central nervous system in the spinal cord. This particular reflex goes into the spinal cord. You don't need the brain for it. Now, your brain, relatively speaking, is in this dimension. Your brain is up here, and there are neurons between your brain and this part of your spinal cord, and they influence, they have input in here, and they influence things. But the point is that this can happen without your brain operating. This is the famous, you know, the hit, you don't need the brain. Yeah?
If we were to complete the picture, would the second interneuron go into that same motor neuron on the top, or would it be in separate?
The second, let's see, where would the second interneuron go? The second interneuron would have to connect to this one. Okay. Now, I want to continue to think about the wiring diagram. How are things hooked up? We've been talking about the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. Now we want to sort of put it together in a more coherent way. And that's actually on the top of your handout. There is a diagram that summarizes that. So one way of looking at it is, here's your central nervous system. This is, of course, the brain and the spinal cord. And there is input, what we have called afferent. And this is both conscious and unconscious, in the sense that things like what your visceral organs are doing and messages they're sending, you're completely unaware of. But things like smell, for example, you are aware of. So both of these put input into the CNS. This is the afferent information. And then information goes out. And that's called efferent, as we've explained. Okay, now we're concerned mostly with the peripheral nervous system. We've talked about sensors, which is sort of this part of it, the afferent. But we're interested really in the efferent part of it, this part of the peripheral nervous system, how the part that connects to, for example, muscle. Now, this also can be divided in half. It has sort of two basic parts. One part consists of motor neurons, what goes to your skeletal muscle. That's called the somatic or voluntary system. And here you have neurons whose cell body, we didn't draw in this picture, is in the central nervous system, but whose axons extend out of it, and then they synapse on skeletal muscle. Now, as shown in this picture, a single axon of a single neuron goes all the way from the spinal cord to whatever the target skeletal muscle is. And as Dr. Feierstein points out, that means you have some very long axons. because you have one, for example, that goes from the middle of your back all the way down to your big toe. And as he said, if you consider the equivalent thing in a blue whale, it's enormous. Now, the somatic or voluntary part of the peripheral efferent peripheral nervous system controls your skeletal muscles. But then the autonomic part controls everything else. As shown in the box here, it controls your smooth muscle, your cardiac muscle, that means your heart, your glands, and the neurons of your GI tract, which in turn control your GI tract. Now, the autonomic is split again. So what we're saying is you can take the nervous system and you can divide it into the central nervous and the peripheral nervous, and then you derive the peripheral nervous into the somatic and the autonomic, which is just what this picture does. But then the autonomic is divided into what's called the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And that's the two arrows on the bottom right quadrant. So each of these is a two-cell relay. I'll put in the cell bodies, which are not shown in your picture. So in the somatic nervous system, one axon stretches all the way to the target effector. But in the autonomic system, there are two axons because there are two cells. There's one cell with its body in the central nervous system, and then it synapses on another cell. And it's the second cell that goes all the way to the target, whether it's a gland, whether it's smooth muscle, whether it's the heart. So the target would be out here. Actually, they both go to the heart. Now, notice a lot of these pictures are not to scale. The cell bodies are too small. The axon, synaptic endings or boutons are too big. You have to keep all of that in mind. But one of the reasons we've drawn these circles here is that all the cell bodies here, there are going to be many neurons which extend this far, and then a second set of neurons which extend to the target. And all the bodies of the second set of neurons are all together. They're all grouped into one group spot, and that's called a ganglion. That's just a bunch of cell bodies. So when you talk about cell number one and cell number two, people often refer to them as the pre- and the post-ganglionic cells. Now, to sort of explain all of this, we have a blow-up of just this part. Part down here, the efferent PNS, and that's on handout B, I think. No, that must be C. That's on the top of C. What we want to do now is look at that in more detail. So what that does really is just to show in a different form what these arrows at the bottom look like. We used to have these special erasers on the other side, but we've lost them. So here again, this is the cell body part that is inside the central nervous system, the part that's not shown on the previous handout, but I put the circles inside. And then you have the axon, and here's the nerve ending, and here's the target organ. So this is the target. Now, the picture I just drew represents the somatic nervous system. In that, so this is all in the central nervous system. You have a single cell whose body is in the central nervous system, whose axon goes all the way to the target, and the target is always skeletal muscle. So that's the somatic nervous system. But now, in the autonomic nervous system, you have a two-cell relay. So I've drawn it typical ones for the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. Again, the cell body is in the central nervous system, and then you have a neuron, and it forms a synapse on a cell body that is in a ganglion, and then that cell has a neuron which synapses on the target. Now, I've drawn the sympathetic and the parasympathetic here, typical ones. Now, what's the point of this autonomic business? The idea is that either of these, well, most targets get input from both the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. We tend to think that the sympathetic juices you up and the parasympathetic calms you down, which is more or less right. But it doesn't mean that the parasympathetic always turns things off and the sympathetic always turns things on. In some cases, that's right. The sympathetic makes your heart beat faster. The parasympathetic makes it slower. But when you consider things like, say, digestion, it's the opposite. The sympathetic slows down digestion. When you're running away from the lion, you don't worry about lunch. On the other hand, the parasympathetic turns up the digestive system because now that things are calmer, you can afford to digest lunch. This also allows you to urinate. The sympathetic causes the bladder to stretch and the muscle to relax so you can hold more, so you can wait until the lion is taken care of. Now, my husband told me that there is a very famous mnemonic, which is sort of male-specific, so I have never heard it, of how to keep straight which is which. And he says that comes from point and shoot. This is how a male carries out the sexual act. It requires the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. You need the parasympathetic to get an erection. But you need the sympathetic and the somatic, it so happens, to ejaculate. Now, why is that? In order to get an erection, the smooth muscle cells around the blood vessels have to relax so that blood can come in and you can get an erection. Now, where does Viagra fit in? It turns out that Viagra helps the relaxation of those muscles. The neurotransmitter involved here happens to be gaseous, and it triggers a second messenger pathway. And the second messenger in this system is not cyclic AMP, but cyclic GMP. Now, what Viagra does is to inhibit the destruction of cyclic GMP. So the neurotransmitter, through a metabotropic receptor, causes the cell to make cyclic GMP. That relaxes the muscles. That allows blood to flow in. But normally, there would be a phosphodiesterase, which would destroy the cyclic GMP and just turn it into GMP. The muscles would stop relaxing, and the erection would end. But Viagra allows the cyclic GMP to stay around longer. The muscles relax longer. And so you have a longer erection. This was discovered by accident. Viagra was originally tried out in order to affect some other signaling system in a different cell type, I think in the heart. And when they found out it doesn't work for that. And when people asked for the pills back, the men said, no. And that's how they discovered that although it doesn't do what they thought it would do in the first place, it's extremely effective at this. Okay. So signaling is not just of academic interest. Now, to come back to our main picture here. So the parasympathetic, then, normally doesn't turn things on necessarily or off, but it does affect its end target such as to calm you down, usually. And the sympathetic usually excites. Now, in the sense... Most organs, as we've said, are innervated by both, but some only by one or the other. And there are some examples in your handout, in your notes, and of course the diagrams in the book of how who's connected to what. Now, what we want to look at is sort of the parallels in these three cases. You notice that in the autonomic, you have two neurons. In the somatic, you have only one. The target is skeletal muscle. In the somatic, it is a gland, smooth muscle, etc. in the autonomic. Now, we already mentioned that in the somatic, the only thing you can do is excite. This happens to be a direct ionotropic receptor. This is the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor here on the skeletal muscle. And so an action potential always causes the release of acetylcholine, which opens channels, which causes the muscle to contract. All that can be given is a positive sign. But these other two the autonomic second neuron uses either acetylcholine or norepinephrine. Usually norepinephrine in the sympathetic and acetylcholine in the parasympathetic. But these receptors now are metabotropic. These are indirect receptors, and there are a whole bunch of different ones, and you can get all kinds of different responses. So sometimes you inhibit the target, sometimes you activate the target. You can get the heartbeat up, the heartbeat down. You can get more salivation, you can get more tears. It depends which case you've got. So this can be plus or minus, and this one's direct. These are indirect. So if this is an acetylcholine receptor, which kind is it? It's the muscarinic kind, the indirect. If it's an adrenergic receptor, it could be alpha or beta. Both are indirect. Now, one way of comparing these is there's neuron number one, and then no neuron number two, neuron number two. The first synapse out is always direct nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. Well, this is the first synapse out. This is the only one. This is the first synapse out. This is the second. First, second. So these two synapses use the same system as the one in the somatic nervous system. So what's the neurotransmitter? It's acetylcholine. And the receptor is the direct nicotinic receptor. And so this is always positive. But the effect on the target, on the gland or the smooth muscle, can be positive or negative. Now, as shown in this picture, the positions of the ganglia in the case of the two parts of the autonomic nervous system are not the same. Then in the case of the parasympathetic, the ganglion is closer to the target. And the case of the sympathetic, it tends to be closer to the spinal cord. The mnemonic for that is S is close to the spinal cord, but PS is proximal or close to the target. Now, just one more piece of this on your handout. We've talked about norepinephrine, which is primarily a neurotransmitter, and epinephrine, which is primarily a hormone. However, usually when you have a lot of one, you have a little of the other one, partially because of the way they're made. Well, where does epinephrine come from? Norepinephrine comes from the end of neurons. So does epinephrine. And the gland that produces epinephrine is often considered part of the sympathetic nervous system. That normally the sympathetic nervous system contacts a target, the second neuron, and the second neuron has a long axon and goes to some target tissue. In the case of the adrenal gland, which is what this is, the second cell has only short neurons. And they secrete epinephrine, not primarily, not norepinephrine, and they secrete it into the bloodstream. So you can think of the adrenal as being the parallel to a ganglion of the sympathetic nervous system. And this is number two. Now, to put the proper names on it, this is called the preganglionic neuron. That's number one. And the second one is called the postganglion. We're really referring to the axon here. The axon of this cell is preganglionic. The axon of this cell is postganglionic. Now, the adrenal gland is like a ganglion, but its postganglionic axon is just short. And so as a result, it releases its transmitter-like molecule, which is really now a neuroendocrine made by nerve cells, but into the blood like an endocrine. This compound goes into the blood. Now, what's the advantage of this system? When you have the proverbial pop quiz, your sympathetic system kicks into action, and the neurons of the sympathetic system go to the target organs and glands and cause the right response. Your brain works better, you breathe more deeply, your muscles generate energy, and you don't have to go to the bathroom. But in addition, your adrenal gland releases epinephrine. Now, which gets to its target faster? Which would you think? A direct line or a sort of broadcast, wait till the blood goes around? You'd think a direct line would, and it does. But it only goes where it's set up to go. It doesn't go everywhere. The broadcast system through the blood reaches everywhere, but it may take longer to get there. So these two reinforce each other, that either epinephrine or norepinephrine reaches the appropriate targets all over the body, allowing you to cope with the crisis. Now, we have one more thing on our handout, which we'll talk about very briefly, and then we'll do that next time. And that's on C, on the bottom. We have pictures of the three different kinds of muscle. We've talked about smooth muscle and skeletal muscle. Smooth muscle is single cells, single small cells. They may be joined by gap junctions and contract as a unit, but they're these little measly-looking cells. Skeletal muscle has these huge stripe cells. They're really multinucleate. They come from the fusion of many cells. And heart cells are sort of in between. Now, when you look at smooth muscle, these unstriped, measly-looking cells, you think, eh, this is just skeletal muscle that didn't make it. Well, this is not true. Smooth muscle has properties which are quite different from skeletal muscle and are of great advantage. Smooth muscle is not just a wannabe skeletal muscle. It serves a different function. Skeletal muscle can develop enormous force. But in order to develop force, it has to constantly split ATP. Smooth muscle can reach a kind of latch state where no more ATP must be put in and it stays contracted. So smooth muscle is found around most of your organs and most of your tubes, because it can maintain this sort of partially contracted state for a longer time with less input. It contracts more slowly, but it relaxes more slowly. So for the same amount of ATP, you get a small amount of force, but for a long time. Now, the other thing we ought to mention is something we've referred to before, and that's regulation. What's with skeletal muscle? You tell it to contract or you don't. That's it. Only input is the somatic system. But with smooth muscle, you have the parasympathetic, the sympathetic, and a whole bunch of hormones. So the regulation of it is much, much more tightly tunable. And so you can adjust, in fact, smooth muscle over a very wide range in response to of contraction in response to many different stimuli. And so maintaining a kind of homeostatic state with it is much, much easier. So what we will talk about next time is the molecular mechanism by which muscles contract. And exam number 3 will cover the material that we did today and no more. That doesn't mean you shouldn't come next Tuesday.